Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio. I almost said How Stuff Works. That's my old employer. But no, iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And we're going to have a really cool throwback today. Yep, it's Friday. It's time for a classic episode. So we are going to listen to How Refrigerators Work. This episode originally published on March 25th, 2013. So let's listen to how fridges work. I totally forgot and I need to chill out. So let's hear it. We're going to talk about refrigerators. And here's the interesting thing, guys. If you listen to the episode that Chris Paulette and I did quite some time ago about air conditioners, this podcast is going to sound very similar to that because the technologies used in air conditioning systems and the technologies used in refrigerators are essentially the same.
Yeah, just one is a more small and controlled and for people, usually.
Right. No, there's some notable exceptions to that. We are not going to talk about those guys because that's creepy and probably belongs in another podcast.
Excellent.
Okay, so we're not talking about people in refrigerators today. Although now I can't think of anything else. But no. First, let's start with what the definition of refrigeration is. So it's defined as the process of achieving and maintaining a temperature below that of the surroundings. And the aim of it is to cool some sort of space or object to a required temperature.
Right, because bacteria grow most rapidly in this, and it's called the danger zone, actually.
Yeah.
In between.
Now I have a new thing filling up my head, but okay, yes,
excellent.
The danger zone.
That's debatably better than body
well,
parts and
Archer,
fingers.
Really.
Okay, well, excellent. The danger zone is in between 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 4.4 to 60 degrees Celsius. And in that temperature range, bacteria really just groove out.
Yeah,
they can more than double in 20 minutes.
Yeah, and the population just explodes.
Yeah.
And bacteria and for things like food, stuff that we would consume, that's not necessarily a great mix. That can lead to some pretty nasty contamination. It can lead to some really serious health problems. And this is why refrigeration is such a big deal. I mean, clearly before we had any kind of refrigeration, we had to look at different ways to preserve food. Otherwise, you pretty much had to get food from the source and consume it right away.
Immediately. Yeah. Or as close to immediately as possible. Or you had to cook it so that it would, yeah.
So it wouldn't spoil as quickly, or you had to salt it like crazy so that, mm-hmm. again, the salting would inhibit the bacteria from reproducing so quickly.
Right.
And even in refrigeration, we still have that process. It's just slowed down quite a bit, which is why you cannot leave food in a refrigerator indefinitely. It will eventually go bad. And then just like in that great Far Side cartoon, the potato salad will hold up the ketchup when potato salad goes bad. So the trick here, though, is how do you create this cool environment, this cold environment? Because adding heat to things is easy. Huh. Taking heat away, not as easy.
Less easy, yes.
And also, before I get all my physicist friends sending in messages about the use of the word heat, I do apologize. We're going to be using it in the vernacular quite a bit because that's really what everyone's familiar with. But to be clear, an object does not possess heat. It has a temperature, but it doesn't possess heat. An object will have internal energy as a result of molecular motion. And heat is really the description of an energy transfer process. And you go from a high temperature object to a lower temperature one. That is the basic concept of heat. It's really an energy transfer. So when we say, like, this object's got a lot of heat to it, that's a completely colloquial way
right.
of saying it. So I do acknowledge that. I apologize. But if you really want someone who's going to be a stickler for science, go bug Robert Lamb, because he loves that. The stuff
yes.
to blow your mind guy. Robert's awesome. I love Robert.
Oh, definitely.
So, that's the way heat works, though. You have high temperature, low temperature, then heat moves from the high temperature to the low temperature. It does not go the other way around, right? Without some sort of external force working on the system. This is essentially one of the basic laws of thermodynamics. And so you've got this, you have to find a way of creating a lower temperature environment to pull heat from, or for heat to transfer from the objects that are inside a refrigerator to make them cool. So that's the basis of refrigeration. But, you know, to get to that point, we had to do a lot of stuff, and we had to understand a lot about physics for this to become what we now all kind of take for granted.
Yeah.
So to get started, I guess we can talk about what the predecessor was to the modern refrigerator, which was the icebox.
Oh, right. Or, you know, going way back in time, you had people not even making ice boxes, but
sure.
just collecting ice and putting it next to stuff.
Yeah, or like maybe, you know, you might have a cellar that you'd put
sure.
ice into, or you might just have a hole in the ground,
mm-hmm.
or you may just, like, if you were in a part of the world where there was a significant amount of snowfall,
mm-hmm.
We here in Georgia are not in that part of the world. We did have some snow the other day. I could see a bare trace of it next to my steps.
Some of it landed in my hair when I walked my dog. That was about it. Yeah.
But if you were in a place where they get a significant amount of snow and there are large snow banks, then one of the things you might do is store some food inside the snow there, bury it in the snow, and just hope that nothing comes along to grab that food.
Or, yeah, if you've got an ice house, you can preserve some of the ice with sawdust or wood shavings. Later on, cork was used to insulate it for a few months anyway, until temperatures warmed up enough.
Right. Yeah, you could definitely slow the process, insulate it enough from the heat of the outside environment so that it would preserve it. You wouldn't lose too much in melt-off. It took a while before people started to figure out the best ways to keep ice from melting too quickly. And it's interesting because just as they were really getting very good and making sure they kept ice cold for as long as possible, even in hot environments, That's when the mechanical refrigeration technology had started to really take off, and it became less important.
Right, right. Yeah, and these were happening simultaneously, which is really fascinating to me. It was in 1775 that the first refrigerating machine was produced. I believe it could make small amounts of ice in a lab.
Yeah, yeah. To really understand, well, first of all, the word refrigerate, I found the earliest use of it.
Yeah.
Which was, or at least the earliest recorded use that I could find, which was from 1550.
Ooh.
But it was all about using chemicals in water. People were discovering that if they added certain chemicals to water, for some reason, the temperature of the water would drop. So if you were to put something in a container of water that had this chemical in it, you could cool that something. Now, if that something was unprotected food and that chemical was poisonous, that was not necessarily a great thing. But if that something were, I don't know, a bottle of wine and you happened to be French, this was a great way to cool your wine. And in fact, in the Renaissance, these cooled drinks became very popular, to the point where if you added chemicals to water, it would drop the temperature enough that if you put something in it that that you could turn on a regular basis, you could actually make ice this way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so this was kind of an early ice maker. Not efficient, not good for producing ice on any kind of large scale, but it was one of those things that the rich people really enjoyed, and really those were the only ones who had any chance of getting at it. But yeah, it was just before your the refrigerator unit type thing you were talking about from the 1770s. 1755 is pretty much when we talk about the origin of the idea. That's when William Cullen made his machine with which used a vacuum and ether to create this environment where he would put water into a container, put a smaller amount of ether in there, put essentially a vacuum bell jar on top, you know, a pump with a pump on it.
Sure.
By creating the vacuum, the ether would start to boil off. And when the ether was boiling off, when it was vaporizing, he noticed that the temperature was going down in the water. And in fact, when the ether would continue to boil off, the water would start to turn into ice. Now, we'll talk about why that is a little bit later, but this was one of those early observations that started to lead people into thinking, you know, if we harness this in some way,
pretty cool.
Yeah, cool.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
You're doing it too. You're doing it too.
I didn't even mean that one. You did yours on purpose.
There's no way to avoid it, Vogelbaum. Join us.
We
will rule the galaxy.
Jonathan, we need to chill out.
Yes, we do. Okay. All right. No, too fast. You gotta pace yourself here. So anyway, this does form the basis. This idea of vapor pulling out heat somehow. That is what was the very basis of mechanical refrigeration. It would be quite a while before the mechanical refrigerators would start to become a real thing.
Right, right.
I have, in 1803, you have Thomas More. Obviously not that one, a different Thomas More. Of Maryland, in fact. He received a U.S. patent for a refrigerator. Now, this was not the same thing as the mechanical refrigerators that would come later. But that same year, that was when the domestic ice box was invented.
Right.
So 1803, you get the domestic ice box. This was usually a wooden cabinet that you would put a large block of ice into the top. And then you would keep your food and consumables in the bottom part of this cabinet. And convection would essentially keep
it cool. Right, because heat rises and cold sinks.
Which we know is a generalization.
Gross generalization, yes.
But in general.
In this particular case.
Yeah, you've got the dense cold air going down and the less dense warm air moving up. Because,
thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we understand that is a gross overgeneralization. But for the purposes of this podcast, it's effective enough. Yeah, you kept that ice on top. You have a drip tray underneath because, hey, that ice is melting. and so you would collect the water, which you would not just pour into the top where it would magically become ice again. Essentially, once that ice was gone, you had to go out and buy more ice.
And actually, the ice trade was really huge right around that time. In 1806, I think Frederick Tudor began his ice empire. He was called the Ice King.
Yeah.
When he started cutting chunks out of the Hudson River and various ponds around Massachusetts and then exporting it as far as China and Australia.
And India, yeah.
And India,
yeah. Also, what's interesting is that India was, the way they were producing ice in India at this time was through a process called nocturnal radiative cooling.
Right, I was reading about this.
It took me a while to grasp how that worked.
I still did not understand it. So, I mean, what I understand that basically they were doing was putting water in shallow clay trays and
yep.
setting it outside under the open sky
mm-hmm.
overnight, and then in the morning ice would be there.
Yeah, what essentially is happening is that the there is another physical process going on here, but you've got a tray of water outside. The sky needs to be clear.
Okay.
Because what's happening is the heat is radiating from the water out into the atmosphere and escaping that way. Now, if there are clouds, then the heat can radiate back down to it, because it's like an insulator.
Wow.
It'll end up insulating the Earth, and you don't get temperatures
you don't
low
get
enough.
Cool enough temperatures,
right.
too.
But otherwise, even if the ambient temperature outside is still right around freezing or just above freezing,
mm-hmm.
you can still freeze water that way under a clear sky. It also helps if it's a very dry climate.
Oh, right, right. And from what I understand, it's important that it's a earthenware tray, because that way you get some of the
Well, you have to have that insulated effect there as well. It's mm-hmm. the earthen tray, and there's usually hay underneath it.
Yeah, some kind of compressed.
Yeah, so it's interesting that was the way that India was producing ice, but that was not a very, again, not a very efficient way of producing ice. You couldn't produce a lot of it, and there was a big demand.
Mm-hmm.
So Tudor was really raking it in by harvesting ice in the United States, just natural ice. He's not producing it in any mechanical means. He's actually going out and digging it up, packing it in wood shavings and that sort of stuff, cork, that kind of thing, shipping it to the other side of the world and making huge bank off of it.
Huge bank. And I want to mention that also right around this time, in 1787, ammonia was first liquefied in a laboratory.
Right.
Which
and
is an
important
point.
Yeah.
So just keep that in your heads for a second.
Right.
And then also in 1805, right before Tudor began his big ice trade, Oliver Evans described a closed ether vacuum refrigeration system.
Yeah. So this is the same sort of mechanical system that would eventually become what we use in refrigerators. Most refrigerators. I'm saying refrigerators in general, but there are different types.
Which we can get into later.
Yeah. We'll mention a few, but we're focusing on what most of us have available in
our
kitchens. And maybe our basement, okay, I'm not going to go back there. It's just, you
back
took
to
me
that dark basement.
You took
place.
Me to a dark place, Vogelbaum, really early on.
Look, I'm very fond of that documentary, American Psycho. So
yeah, okay, that's fair. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to go raid the fridge, and we'll be right back.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1820, this is interesting, Michael Faraday was working again with liquid ammonia, and that's when he started realizing that liquid ammonia, which ammonia's naturally at room temperature is a gas.
Right, because it boils it at like negative 27 degrees Fahrenheit.
So to liquefy it, you have to compress it. You have to pressurize it to make it a liquid. And he realized that when it went from liquid back to gas, it caused cooling. And so, again, another important part of this mechanical refrigeration. Yeah. Now, in 1821, a German physicist by the name T.J. Seebeck discovered that if you have two junctions of dissimilar metals kept at two different temperatures, it induces electromotive force or electric current. So what that means is that, let's say that you have a junction of a copper wire and an iron wire, mm-hmm. all right? And then you have a second junction where the iron wire is attached to a second copper wire.
Got it.
And let's say you were to heat up that first junction and cool down the second junction, perhaps put some ice on it, mm-hmm. you would actually induce electricity to flow through that wire. Now, that's important because in 1834, Peltier discovers that if you do the opposite, if you put electricity through a series of wires that have these kind of junctions,
one side will heat up and the other side will cool
down.
Off.
Exactly.
And by up to, I think, 40 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yeah, it all depends on what kind of material you're using.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this sort of it's called the Peltier effect, actually. But this sort of effect is dependent upon the types of metals or materials you're using and their purity.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using pure metals, the effect is pretty small, so small as to not be very useful. It's interesting in a laboratory setting, but not terribly useful. Also, if you're using pure metals, they tend to be very good thermal conductors,
right.
Which means that difference in temperature will not maintain itself for very long. You will eventually have the heat will move from the high temperature to the low temperature and balance that out. Meanwhile, if you were to use an insulator, then you wouldn't get the effect. So
right.
It would take years before anyone would find a way to make that useful. But that is used, that same technique is used in some little portable refrigerator type
right.
things, like the kind of stuff you might plug into your car outlet.
Sure, yeah. Basically, you just get a whole bunch of these junctions set up. You put the hot ones outside the unit, the cool ones inside the unit,
yeah.
and voila, fridge.
Yep, that's exactly it. So spoiler alert, that's how that one works. But we thought it'd be interesting to talk about that. But that was the basis of that sort of refrigerator. And that same year, in 1834, Jacob Perkins developed a vapor compression cycle refrigerator using ether. So you got a lot of people working on this.
Yeah, this was the first patent for it. That year.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And 1844, you had John Gorey proposing an air cycle refrigerating machine for making ice. 1850, you had Rudolf Clausius, who said, heat can never pass from a colder to a warmer body without some other change connected therewith occurring at the same time. This is what I was talking about at the top of the podcast. It's kind of a rewording of the second law of thermodynamics. It's related to that. So that's one of the principles that guided refrigeration as well. In 1851, our buddy John Gorey, from back when he had proposed that air cycle refrigeration machine to create ice, in 1851, that's when he got the another patent for mechanical refrigeration. And in 1855, Alexander Twining starts his first commercial ice-making plant using vapor compression refrigeration.
Oh, wow.
We'll explain what that is in more detail in a little bit. 1856, commercial refrigeration begins in industries like brewing and meatpacking. Now, commercial refrigeration did not necessarily mean they were using mechanical refrigeration. They could be using natural refrigeration, as in going out and buying lots and lots of
big ice
and packing
yeah,
stuff
sure.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me that brewing picked up on this really quickly. Like the brewing companies were like, we want beer that tastes good.
It's as though alcohol technology is something that drives industry in some way.
Yeah, the meat packers were slower to follow suit, which
well,
is disturbing.
Spoiled meat was something everyone was used to.
Right.
But tasty.
And if you're drunk enough, you don't care.
Precisely.
Okay, got it. I understand now. As someone who does not imbibe alcohol, it was just completely foreign to me. But I don't eat meat either, so why do I care? Also, we're no longer in the 1850s, as it turns out. But yeah, meatpacking was slow to adopt this technology, but it did start it back in the 1850s. And the majority of plants wouldn't switch to mechanical refrigeration until about 1914. And by then, you were getting into a really, like, a booming time of refrigeration. But backtracking just a touch, in 1859, we had Ferdinand Carr of France, who developed an ammonia-slash-water refrigeration machine. 1868, you had Peter van der Weyde. He patents thermostatically controlled refrigeration systems. That's going to be important when we get to the modern refrigerator. 1870, Carl Lind publishes a paper called The Extraction of Heat at Low Temperature by Mechanical Means. And he designs the first practical portable compressor refrigeration machine in 1873. In 1877, that was the peak of the ice trade.
Yes.
So in the U.S., that it hit its peak right in the late 1870s. The United States was exporting almost a quarter of a million tons of ice to other countries.
Wow.
So, yeah, a lot of ice leaving the United States. It's interesting to me that at this point, where the ice trade is at its peak, but mechanical refrigeration is already in its infancy,
mm-hmm.
the only reason that mechanical refrigeration even started to take off, it wasn't because the technology was getting great. It's because the ice trade was starting to encounter problems once it gets to about the 1890s or so.
Yeah.
Like, if the ice trade had not encountered problems, then even with the technological advances in mechanical refrigeration, we may not have seen refrigerators in the United States for another, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 decades.
Wow.
But,
yeah.
So, yeah, and what happened was that as people were essentially mining ice, you know,
sure.
cutting away ice from these rivers and ponds, they were starting to exhaust the clean sources of water.
Oh.
And so more and more of the ice, the demand was growing, mm-hmm. right? And the supply was diminishing. Not that we were running out of lakes and rivers and stuff. It's just the demand was so great.
It was so great that there wasn't enough to go around.
Yeah, there's only so many that are frozen.
And the Hudson is really big and stuff. But yeah. I mean, you know, when you're talking about a quarter of a million tons. That's...
Right. So you're talking about tons of ice that might have things like sewage in them. Not so great when you're using it in the meat packing industry, as
Less
it turns
tasty.
Out.
Yeah,
yeah, maybe not such a big advantage over spoiled meat. It was because the ice industry was starting to have these issues that we began to see the rise of mechanical refrigeration. 1891 was when a trade journal called Ice and Refrigeration began to publish. 1904 was when the American Society of Refrigerating Engineers was founded. By the way, the American Society of Refrigerating Engineers, I learned, was about engineers who were experts in refrigeration. It was not a society that would actually refrigerate engineers. because the way it was worded, it was confusing.
I find that difficult to believe, Jonathan. I think you should check your sources.
American Society of Refrigerating Engineers. It does sound like you're just shoving a guy with a hard hat into a fridge. And that brings us back to American Psycho. 1911, General Electric introduced the first domestic refrigerator, depending upon whom you ask.
Right, yeah.
We should also point out that when we've got these dates and saying who brought out the first one, et cetera, et cetera, there's some dispute in them, and it all, like, I've seen conflicting timelines.
History, and especially scientific and corporate history, tends to be written by the victors. And
yeah.
So therefore, sometimes, you know, different reports differ about exactly who won that.
Yeah, and, right. And, yeah, exactly. 1913, according to some sources, that's the first electric refrigerator. According to, actually, Frigidaire's timeline, tell you specifically. 1916 was when models like the Kelvinator and Servel were introduced, and in 1918, General Motors purchased Guardian Refrigerator Company and renamed it Frigidaire. So 1918 was when Frigidaire as a thing became a thing. Like, it existed before, but it didn't exist in, like, it didn't have the Frigidaire
by name. Right. And Frigidaire is where we get the word fridge from, I do believe.
I believe so. And it's also, that's the company that developed Freon, which we will talk about a little bit.
In just a moment, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Way up in the 1930s, we've got like one other point to cover before then.
Well, I've got a couple more, actually. Because I've got three in the 20s. Here we go.
Oh, my goodness.
So 1925. In the USA, there were about 25 million domestic refrigerators, only 75,000 of which were mechanical. So these refrigerators, some of them were more like the icebox refrigerators.
Right, right. Well, I remember watching, like, Lassie growing up, that the mom in Lassie had an icebox, not a fridge. Random.
The mom in Lassie, not the mom and Lassie. For a moment, I thought Lassie had its own fridge. I'm like, that dog was luckier than I was. 1927 was the first porcelain on steel cabinet refrigerator, that's the one I always think of, like the 1950s refrigerator, the big porcelain ones.
Right, right. Looks a little bit like a rocket. Yeah.
Yeah, mine's a steel refrigerator. I've got the stainless steel thing going now. So,
but fancy.
I remember the porcelain ones. The 1929 was when Frigidaire introduced the first home food freezer, and it was a chest style freezer. So,
okay.
You know, not the upright type, not incorporated into a refrigerator. And that was right around that time is when Frigidaire starts to introduce chlorofluorocarbons.
Right. I believe that DuPont had developed, it's also called a Freon.
Yeah. That's the patented specific chlorofluorocarbon that Frigidaire introduced.
Right. And before then, some of the very early fridges, I believe, were using sulfur dioxide.
Yeah.
And
sulfur dioxide, methyl chloride.
Ammonia.
Yeah. And these are all chemicals that are toxic.
Super toxic.
So whenever there were accidents, and you know, we're human, accidents happen.
It happens.
Then sometimes people were really badly injured or even they died even as a result of being exposed to these sort of chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a big incentive for companies to develop refrigerants that were not toxic.
Yeah.
And so that was the reason why companies were looking into something like a chlorofluorocarbon. Now, later on, we would learn other downsides to chlorofluorocarbons, which we'll talk about in a second, which is why we don't use them anymore.
Right.
Now, in 1931, that was the first use of Freon as a refrigerant. So it was kind of introduced in 1929, and by 1931, it was being incorporated into the design of mechanical refrigerators. And in 1948, the first refrigerator-freezer combo with the freezer having its own separate section was introduced. So that was where, you know, you would open up the fridge part or you would open up the freezer part. And in 1949, Soviet engineers discovered a way to create thermoelectric refrigeration systems using the Peltier effect by using semiconductor material.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, like I said, those pure metals weren't producing enough of an effect for it to be useful in any way. They found that by using semiconductor materials, they could create a temperature differential that was effective enough for it to be used for something.
It's science.
So, yeah, they actually started creating refrigerators using that thermoelectric system rather than the vapor compression system that was being used pretty much everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Also, in 1949, the business was so booming that 7 million refrigerators were being produced in the U.S. annually.
Nice. And in fact, my timeline ends at 1949 because I didn't write down specifically the bit about the 1970s, where right around the 1970s was when we started figuring out the chlorofluorocarbons were starting to accumulate in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and eat through the ozone layer, which is not the science for that. That's
right, right. But that it was in fact harming the ozone layer, and that was what gave the incentive for us to develop something besides that.
Yeah, which is why these days hydrofluorocarbons or isobutane or
right. Yeah, those are your main two to be used because they don't have the same environmental impact. Nor do they have the same toxicity levels as the previous refrigerants before Freon.
Yeah, ammonia and things are still used in industrial capacity because they assume that someone who has, you know, $5,000 to drop on a refrigerator is going to, or $5,000 more on top of what you would normally spend, is going to take a little bit better care of it and not, you know, let the dog eat through the back end.
Yeah, but it's one of those things also where you're talking about efficiency as well. Ammonia is a very efficient refrigerant. So that's, you know, when you're talking about a large scale production, efficiency ends up being the difference between a profitable year and a disaster.
Yeah, especially when you've got health inspectors coming through making sure that you do not have any food that is entering that danger zone that I talked about.
Right. So that kind of brings us up to speed to the general refrigerator of today. Let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so I think it's time we start talking about the actual process of refrigeration and how the modern day refrigerator in general works.
You mean the technology of it? Like we're a tech show?
Yeah, as if we were talking about the stuff that is tech. Yes.
Crazy talk.
So you're using essentially the refrigerator cooling system is a closed system.
Right. All right.
It's a closed system. Think of it as a series of tubes. So it's its own internet. But it's a series of tubes that are all connected to one another. There's no external, you know, venting or anything.
Right.
Or intake. So you've got a system where you're using a refrigerant, like we were talking about
a
in those
coolant.
Early days.
Yes.
Yeah, some sort of material that at room temperature is a gas, but when you pressurize it, you can make it a liquid. And that's the key. So, if you're having trouble understanding how this works, think about you get some rubbing alcohol and put a little bit on your skin and you're going to feel that it feels very cool. And that's not because the rubbing alcohol itself is at a cooler temperature.
Right.
Yeah. The liquid in the bottle, when you hold the bottle, it can feel like it's the same temperature as the room.
Right.
Right. But the thing is that rubbing alcohol will start to evaporate at room temperature. So when you put it on your skin, as it evaporates, you're going to feel your skin cool down. That evaporative effect, as the liquid is turning into a vapor, it's pulling heat
through part of that physical reaction. Endothermic reaction, the energy that is required to turn something from a liquid to a vapor, sucks in energy, heat energy from the air around it.
And you've got the higher temperature generated by your body. So that's where that heat can come from. It can pull the heat from there to help fuel this reaction, essentially. Again, we're kind of oversimplifying. But
yeah, but we're also not physicists. And so
we also don't have visual effects to show you what we mean, which makes
aside from our own gesticulation, which is really only benefiting us.
Yeah. Yes, we can also do the safety dance in here, apparently. That's what it looks like whenever I start talking. That's just the way I am. But okay, so you've got the coolant in your refrigerator, which is called a refrigerant. The coolant moves through a series of coils. And through different parts of the system, the coolant is either going to be in a liquid state or a gas state. Now, you have to think of this system in its various parts. So it's kind of hard to say on one end of the system because really in a way this is kind of like a big circle.
So you
don't have a start and an end really.
But I think it's easy to start with the compressor.
So yeah, you've got a compressor. The compressor is, of course, does what it sounds like it does.
It compresses.
Compresses the gas. So it's
It compresses the coolant at the time. Is it a gas?
Yes, it's a gas.
Excellent.
It's compressing it. So it's coming in through, it's pulling in gas and compressing it. Now, remember we said that heat is not a thing that an object possesses. Instead, an object possesses some sort of internal energy. So if you were to pressurize something, like a gas, if you were to pressurize a gas, or you were to heat up that gas, you would increase the molecular movement there.
Mm-hmm.
And just from observing the gas itself without having any knowledge of how it got that way, you would be unable to tell whether it had achieved its internal motion through heat, pressurization, or some combination between the two. They would be indistinguishable.
They all look the same.
Right.
Right.
So essentially what I'm saying is that compression and heat get you the same result. So you are compressing this gas, and as a result, the temperature of that gas
goes up.
All right. So you then create this long series of coils.
This is on the outside of the fridge.
Exactly.
The compressor is right at the edge of the fridge. It draws the air in.
Yeah, it draws the gas.
Draws the gas from the fridge out to the outside.
Right.
It compresses it, and then it proceeds up through the series of coils.
Yeah, and keep in mind, like I said, this is totally a closed system. This gas is not exposed to the interior of your refrigerator. It's always in tubes, essentially.
Right.
It's always in pipes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going through, after it gets compressed, it heats up. It heats up through the compression. And then it goes through this series of coils. As it goes through the series of coils on the outside of the refrigerator, it starts to lose some of that. The heat moves from the coils to the surrounding atmosphere.
Right. That is the purpose of these coils, to cool down this air to the point that it's going to condense. Sorry.
It's okay. Just don't want it to be too vague.
Right.
But yes, yes, exactly. It's cooling down the gaseous coolant, right? Because at this point, that compressed gas is at a higher temperature than the ambient air around it. So
correct.
If you were to touch one of these coils, you would feel that it was very hot.
Yes. We don't necessarily recommend doing
that. No, don't do it.
Don't do that.
And this also shows that the refrigerator is only going to work if it's in an environment that is cooler than what the coils are. Like if for some reason you put a refrigerator in the middle of a volcano, then the
if
air
if it were above like 140 degrees, it probably wouldn't do
right,
too well.
Because then you have the temperature of the surrounding environment is higher than the temperature of the coils. The heat transfer would move in the opposite direction.
The gas would never cool down.
Right.
So yeah.
So clearly you have to have a cooler temperature in your environment. In this case, it's in your kitchen. And your kitchen, while even when you're cooking full blast, feels like it gets pretty warm, is nowhere near as hot as those coils are first when the gas is compressed. So as it moves through, it starts to cool down and it begins to condense. And under that compression, under that pressure, this condensed cooler gas becomes a liquid, because as you increase the pressure on a liquid, you also increase its boiling point.
Right.
So if you were to take let's take water. Okay, so water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius. It's so much easier to talk in terms of Celsius.
It is.
Although I'm so used to everything else being in Fahrenheit that water is the only thing that makes sense to me in Celsius.
Right.
So, but that's because I'm an ignorant American. All right. So, and I'm not saying all Americans are ignorant. I'm saying I am. So anyway, so at 100 degrees Celsius, that's normally when water would boil.
Sure.
Right. Water under one atmosphere of pressure. If you were to increase the pressure on that pot of water, let's say we somehow put a pressure cooker around this a pressure canister around this pot of water and increase the pressure on that water, that would also increase the boiling point. So you would actually have to go over 100 degrees Celsius in order to get that water to boil.
Mm-hmm.
Same sort of idea here. You've got this compressed gas. You've got it condensed down into a liquid. That means the boiling point has gone up. So as long as that liquid is under pressure, the boiling point is higher than it normally would be. That's why it can be a liquid.
Right.
All right, so you've got this liquid. It would normally be a gas at this temperature. How do you make this liquid suddenly magically make everything cool again? Well, you got to have a valve.
Right.
An expansion valve.
Joule Thompson or Joule Kelvin, depending on how you want to say the
Lord Kelvin's
Lord,
name.
Lord Kelvin, yes.
Came
up with this ingenious little valve concept where if you have a high-pressure liquid on one side and a very tiny hole,
right,
and a low pressure area on the other side,
right,
stuff happens.
Right. What happens is that liquid will pass through that expansion valve. Once it gets to the area of low pressure, now you don't have the pressure on there anymore. Once the pressure's gone, that boiling point goes back down to where it normally would be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, with the refrigerants you're using in the refrigerator, that boiling point is way lower than room temperature.
Negative 28 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 33 degrees Celsius.
So that's when this liquid would normally boil off into a gas. Okay, here's the other cool thing about boiling points. Let's say that you are magically inside an oven. Don't ask me why you went in there, but you're okay. For some, you're very heat resistant.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you've got you have that pot of water from the pressure experiment earlier.
Okay.
We don't like to waste.
No. So especially not water. It's a
precious resource.
Precious resource. Yeah.
So you've taken that pot of water with you into the oven, and you're watching the water, and the temperature inside the oven is 400 degrees, and you're watching the water boil, and you have a thermometer inside the water. It doesn't have any contact with the metal or anything. It's just measuring the temperature of the water. The temperature of the water, even though the oven is 400 degrees, temperature of the water is still going to be, assuming regular pressure, 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius.
Because that water physically cannot go above that temperature.
Not at liquid form.
Mm-hmm.
No, because when you're in liquid form, you can go only up as high as the boiling point, and then you turn into gas.
And then you turn into something else.
So the water itself is at 100 degrees Celsius. So to you, because, you know, you're in the 400 degree air, to you, the water would actually seem cold.
Sure.
Right? So that's the whole idea, is that once it goes down to this boiling point, the temperature actually drops dramatically. So it goes through the expansion valve. The liquid, the highly pressurized liquid, goes through this expansion valve, hits the area of low pressure, immediately boils off. And because
most of it, from what I've read, about half of it boils off.
Well, yeah, because again, you're getting into this low pressure system, mm-hmm. which means that now it's no longer confined by the high pressure.
Right.
Which means now it can boil off into its vapor form, which means that it starts pulling in heat to essentially be part of this process.
Yeah, yeah. As the process happens, it pulls in heat necessarily, because that is where the energy for the process comes from.
So what that means for your refrigerator is that the interior of your refrigerator, all the heat that's contained within the interior of your refrigerator moves to these,
gets sucked into the pipes.
Yeah. So the same sort of series of coils that you would find on the outside of your refrigerator, something similar to that is on the inside of your refrigerator. Only there, instead of putting heat out, it's pulling heat in.
Right.
Because it's pulling heat in from the interior of your refrigerator and freezer. There's really just more length of it freezer than there is in your refrigerator. That's the difference there.
Yeah. So this liquid, this half liquid, half gas, is running through the coils inside the body of the fridge, and fans are blowing air across the coils through the food part of the fridge,
right?
Which continues to vaporize the rest of the liquid into gas,
right?
And continues to pull
more heat. Yep, and that's what makes the refrigerator cold. So really, it's not that the refrigerator is pushing cold in; it's pulling heat out. So that's something,
which is so cool.
Yeah, when you open up a refrigerator and you feel that little blast of cold air, you just think, "Oh, there's something magically
pressing cold in."
Yeah, that's not what's happening. So, but it is really neat to think about that. That's all going on at the same time. So you're talking about two closed systems: the closed system of the interior of the refrigerator, where all your food is, and the closed system of the actual coolant that's moving through. And that's the basic idea. Once the gas gets to the end of that part of the cycle, you know, it's completely in gas form, it's no longer pressurized, that's when the compressor pulls that gas through to move it all the way through the system again. So it's reusing the same coolant over and over and over again.
With no waste.
Right. Assuming there are no leaks in the system, you're good to go.
Right.
If you've ever had to have a refrigerator or freezer unit, if you had to have coolant added to it, this happens frequently, I've seen, with air conditioning systems, or climate systems, then that means there has to be a leak somewhere in there, because it is a closed system, and otherwise you shouldn't really have any loss, at least not any appreciable loss.
Yeah.
So that's the basic way a fridge works. I find it super interesting. I almost said cool. I almost did it. I didn't want to do that.
I think, did I do that a second ago? I apologize. I apologize for accidental puns, guys.
But you might be wondering, okay, well, my refrigerator allows me to set a temperature, mm-hmm. right? Like I can choose to either go super
total
cold.
Arctic blast.
Yeah, for my freezer, I want it to be as cold as possible. Mm-hmm. Or you might think, well, no, that's going to use up a lot of energy. I'm going to be a little
more... when the stuff in your cheese drawer is starting to frost over and you start going like, this is bad.
So what governs that is what's called a thermocouple, which is essentially a thermometer and a switch. So the thermometer detects the temperature, the interior of the refrigerator, and when it drops below whatever the temperature is set to, it turns off electricity to the compressor. So the compressor stops, which means this whole cycle that we've been talking about stops. And then if the temperature creeps up above it again, it turns electricity back on. Yeah. So that's when, if you've ever heard your refrigerator just kind of kick on, mm-hmm. that's what's going on. And, the more modern ones do this really efficiently. So you don't have it happen as frequently or as dramatically. Mm-hmm. I remember an old refrigerator I had where you thought that, you know, perhaps Steven Spielberg was filming Poltergeist 4 in your kitchen.
Every time it kicked in?
Yeah.
Modern fridges also do contain small low wattage heaters, which just keeps the evaporator coils at the correct temperature and not frosted over.
Right.
Which I find also fascinating. Like fridges contain heaters. That's a thing that they do.
Yeah. And you know, obviously refrigerators can have lots of other bells and whistles on them.
Of course.
Sometimes literally my refrigerator does ding. If I'm using the, there has a water dispenser, right?
Okay.
So it intakes water from my house's water system and puts it through a filter, and then I can get a nice clean glass of water. But if you open up the other door, it's a double door refrigerator.
Sure.
If you open up the other door, it cuts the water off. You can't dispense water while a door is open. And if you have depressed the water dispenser, it will bring at you and mercilessly chide you for trying to do two things that are not compatible. Because I frequently forget while I'm getting a glass of water, I'm thinking, you know what would go great with this water? That enormous hunk of cheese that's in my refrigerator. And then my refrigerator tells me that, yes, indeed, that would be lovely, but you need to wait until you've either gotten the cheese or finish getting your glass of water. You cannot do both at the same time.
That's great. I love it when electronics chide me. And by love, I mean hate. I hate that thing.
Well, and there are other kind of interesting like additions you can get. LG has a beer chiller.
Yeah.
So this is this thing. I actually got to see this in person. At CES.
Oh, that's right, because it was at CES,
CES 2012.
I think it won like the Innovator Award.
Yes,
that year,
it did. It won one of the Innovation Awards. So this is like a tiny little thing, chamber within the refrigerator part itself.
It's called a blast chiller.
Yeah, it's designed to take the demo was a can of beer from room temperature to ice cold within about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially it's doing the same process we talked about right here. It's just that I imagine there are more of those coils.
It's a very small chamber and, very controlled.
Yeah,
so.
There are fans involved. I mean, they're trying to increase the circulation of air and the surface area that the cold coils have, so that it pulls heat as efficiently as possible, so that you can have your frosty beverage when you want it, or mm-hmm. at least 5 minutes after you thought about it. And that's assuming you want one can. If you want two, it's going to take about 8 minutes because it's more heat for it to disperse. But yeah, there's stuff like that. And then there's smart refrigerators.
Right. Yeah. Now you can have your fridge, tell you what's in it and what kind of recipes you can make with that.
And send information to other elements in your home, assuming that they are made by the same company.
and are compatible, are willing to talk to each other.
Yeah. So the idea here, of course, is that, and it's not a new idea. It's one of those things that people have been trying to implement in various ways.
But like, now that we have smartphones, it's a little easier.
Yeah, because you can connect a smartphone to a refrigerator and scan things in that way. That was the big issue, right? Was that how do you tell a refrigerator what's inside of it?
If you have to stand there and manually input onto probably a really miserable touchpad on the refrigerator's surface, like how many bananas you have, I never want to do that.
You don't put bananas in the refrigerator?
I do not put
what
bananas.
What are you thinking? Okay, well, Vogelbaum, I've found your problem. No, but you are correct. That's the barrier, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it so easy? And, you know, there were people who were talking about, why don't you put RFID chips or strips of some sort onto various products, and then you could just have it scanned when you put it in. But then other people were saying, wait, if you have RFID chips, you can end up tracking everything that someone buys, whether they want to be part of a customer, you know,
customer
loyalty
program
or not.
Yeah.
And there are people who are very sensitive about that, and I can completely understand. You know, I personally, I don't worry about it that much, but that's just because that's who I am.
I'm willing to do it so that I can get my 55-cent yogurt coupon.
Right.
And that,
right.
You know, but I'm
I totally understand the people who are like, look,
oh, sure.
No one has any business knowing what I buy. I go out and
totally.
I buy it. I buy it with my money. It's my exchange. That's all that's where it should end. I totally respect that. So the RFID thing never really, I mean, I've seen some implementations of it, but I don't expect
never really
that
got off the ground.
Yeah,
because
it would also require the entire food industry to change, right?
Right.
All the packaging would have to change. And that's, when you look at that across every single company that makes food that's designed to go into a refrigerator, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That would require billions of dollars of investment from various companies.
Yeah, for relatively low usage point, I think.
Yeah, yeah, especially right now, because we're talking about, you know, right now I don't think there are that many people who have smart refrigerators.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like to get one that's really useful that can work with something else, like say your oven, so that you know, you pull up a recipe on your refrigerator and it's telling you what you can make based upon the ingredients that it knows that you have available. And you say, yes, that's what I want. I'm going to make chicken a la king. And you push the button. And then it could actually, if it's part of this sort of network system, could send information to the oven so that the oven starts to preheat
to the correct temperature to make chicken a la king.
Right. While you are actually pulling the materials out so that you can prep them for cooking. So this way it ends up making the whole experience more efficient.
And could even potentially, send another note out to your cell phone the next time that you're in a shopping market and say, by the way,
you really like this one thing because you made it like 14 times in the last 2 months, but maybe you want it again.
Uh-huh. or maybe you're out of chicken you were planning on doing something else later this week. Maybe you need to buy more chicken.
Yeah, it just tells you, go out there and buy more chicken. Now, the thing that I find interesting is that we're talking about this. These are kind of future applications. They're really coming into practice now. And we'll probably see more of that in the next maybe 5 or 10 years. It's going to take a while before this technology to get out there far enough for it to be pervasive, especially, you know, once you buy a big appliance like a refrigerator, you want that to last for a while.
Right, yeah.
It's not something you replace every couple of years.
30-year kind of investment,
it can be.
I think it definitely can be.
So I think this is one of those things that we're going to see kind of played around with, like high-end homes and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't imagine I'll be buying a smart refrigerator anytime in the near future, unless I just win the lottery or something. I'm like, I don't know what else to do with this.
Fridges for everyone.
Right.
Fridge party.
Like, just knock on random doors. Guess what you won today? Yeah, I don't know otherwise. But it is interesting to me because I sit there and I think about the time back when people were like, well, we could buy a mechanical refrigerator, but ice is so available. So who knows what will happen. Anyway, so that's how refrigerators work.
All right, guys, that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff, How Refrigerators Work. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have suggestions for future topics of Tech Stuff, please let me know. You can let me know on Facebook or Twitter. The handle for both of those is Tech Stuff, HSW, and I will talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.